We've been talking about orders within the class and secta. We talked about the order Isoptera, which are the termites. The next order that we want to talk about is the order Dermaptera. Derma means skin, and Tera again means wings. So these are sometimes called the skin-winged insects. Maybe a more common name that you're more familiar with is the earwigs. And so the earwigs belong to the order Dermaptera. And if you look at their wings are kind of reduced and they look like pieces of skin, therefore the name Dermaptera. Probably the most distinguishing characteristic of the Dermaptera, however, are these pincher-like cerci that are found on the posterior portion of the abdomen. The Dermaptera feed many times on dead and decaying organic material. They can feed on live plant material as well. You might have seen them in your ears of corn, for example, before, or they might feed on your tomato plants. But mainly they feed on dead and decaying organic material and can be a little bit of a pest. Typically, if you try and control earwigs, they're fairly easy to control because their life cycles are relatively long in relationship to other insects that might be pests, such as cockroaches. Any questions about the Dermaptera? The next order is the order Hemiptera. Heme means half and Tera means wing. These organisms have more than just a half of a wing. But what they do have is they have something that we call a hemolytra. Okay. Now a hemolytra means half of an elytra. And so the first thing is, what is an elytra? Well, an elytra is what beetles have. Beetles have, their forewings are hardened. So if you look at a beetle, they look very hard and you can see the forewings are completely hardened. With the true bugs, the Hemiptera, what they have is they have a hemolytra. So the front half of their wings are somewhat hard, and then the back half are membranous, okay? And so that's what we call a hemolytra. This order is sometimes what we call the true bugs. And even if you're an English major, you know what a true bug is, because true bugs, when we write their common names, the word bug is written separately, okay? So like a ladybug is a true bug. It's not. Ladybug is one word, right? Okay. So something like an assassin bug or a stink bug, most of what you guys think are stink bugs, however, are actually stink beetles. But the box elder bugs that you see in classrooms, if you look at them next time, pick one of them up and you can actually see this hemolytra, the front half of the wing being hard, the back half being somewhat membranous. Okay, so that's a hemolytra. Alright. In addition, the bugs have sucking mouth parts. They typically feed on the fluids of plants or sometimes animals, and those sucking mouth parts are found anteriorly on the head. We're going to show you that here in just a minute. This is a bug that's feeding on a plant, and you can actually see the sucking mouth part looks like a siphon, and it's found right at the very tip or the most anterior part of the head. So that's one of the characteristics of the bugs. Bugs can spread diseases in plants especially. They typically don't spread too many diseases in animals because most of them are not predatorial. This is one exception. This is an assassin bug, and it actually is feeding on this caterpillar right here. Okay, and assassin bugs can bite you. This is an immature assassin bug. I can tell it's immature because if you look up there, you can see its wing pads, but it doesn't have a hemolytra yet. Okay. This is a stink bug, and on this stink bug you can see a lot of little baby stink bugs as well, but you can easily see the hemolytra on this picture. Here's the front half of the wings are hard, the back half are membranous. Okay. This, you can tell stink bugs from other bugs because this little triangular structure here, this, you tell them, goes clear back into the membranous part of the hemolytra. Any questions about the bugs? Another group of insects that are very similar to the bugs is the order Homoptera. Homo means same, so their order name means same wing. Now, sometimes the order Homoptera do not have wings, but when they do have wings, both pairs of wings look almost identical. And so the Homoptera include organisms such as your aphids, cicadas, and spittlebugs, tree hoppers, leaf hoppers. If you go up to a plant, you see little insects hopping around on the plant. They're barely visible. Many times they're homopterans. Most of you know what an aphid is, right? And cicadas, they're the insects that when you walk out in the field in the summertime, when you first hear them, they make noises. When you first hear them, you kind of think, oh, it's a rattlesnake. But then you think, oh, it's not really a rattlesnake, right? They kind of have a buzzing type of a sound. But the Homoptera, when they do have wings, their wings are found, their wings are identical. But probably a better way to tell these organisms is by looking at their mouth parts. They have sucking mouth parts, but those sucking mouth parts are found posteriorly on the head. So with the bugs, you know, their head, the mouth parts were found right at the anterior portion of the head. With the Homopterans, their sucking mouth parts come from about here on their body. Okay. So here are a few aphids that you can see here. They belong to the order Homoptera. This Homopteran here is a spittlebug. This is a blade of grass. And its feed, the Homopterans as well as the Hemipterans, feed mainly on plant juices, and they can be important pests of plants. And these spittlebugs, what it's doing is it's eating the photosynthates from this grass, and then this is its waste here, and it looks like a bunch of spit. Actually, these are fairly common out in the wild. If you ever brush against a piece of blade of grass or a leaf that feels like somebody spit on it, if you look really close, you might see the spittlebug. As you can see, they're about half the width of a blade of grass. Or you may look and see that it's just your buddy that walked in front of you that spit. And so you're actually looking at spit, right? Any questions about the Homoptera? The next order is the order Thysanoptera. This is kind of a minor order, but I want to cover it because some of you may run into this order in your lifetime. The order Thysanoptera are the thrips. The thrips are mostly almost microscopic. They're usually a millimeter or two long, and so you can barely see them with the naked eye. And you can only see them if you know what you're looking for. The order Thysanoptera, their key characteristic is their forewing or front wing is fringed. So you can see the fringing here on the forewing or front wing. These insects feed on flowers and flower parts many times, and that's why they can be important to you, because many of you will want to grow flower gardens, where they can be cause especially bad problems are with rose bushes. Okay, on these flowers here, you can see all these little dark spots. Those are the thrips. Okay, now most flowers will have thrips on them, but if you take your flower and you kind of just if you take a white sheet of paper and just gently tap your flower onto the white piece of paper, if there's all sorts of insects moving around, you probably should spray them for thrips. But if there's just, you know, a handful of thrips running around, it's probably not that big of a deal. Again, as I said, where you can have serious problems with thrips is in rose bushes. They can totally decimate a rose bush and the flowers on the rose. And typically, if you're growing roses, you want to have beautiful flowers, right? So if you see the petals of the flower starting to turn brown, little holes all over in the petals, it's probably due to a thrip problem. Okay. Any questions about the thrips? Okay, the next order is the order Coleoptera. The order Coleoptera are the beetles. And the beetles are the most diverse group of animals in the world. Almost a third of all species of organisms in the world belong to the order Coleoptera. So there are more different species of Coleoptera than there are of plants. And so it's a very, very diverse group of organisms. But the key characteristic of the order Coleoptera is the elytron. If we look at these beetles here, you can see the elytra or the hardened forewing. Okay. Underneath that hardened forewing, they do have a membranous hindwing, and many of the beetles fly regularly. A lot of times when you see beetles, they're actually not flying, but most of you have seen ladybird beetles or ladybugs. You know, they have that hardened elytron on their forewing, and then they have the membranous hindwings that they used to fly with, and most of you have seen that before. Also, what most of you think of as stink bugs. When you think of a stink bug, most of you think of these little black things that put their rear end up in the air, right? They're actually stink beetles, okay? They're actually a beetle. And around here we have just unbelievably diverse amounts of beetles. Many of the beetles are predatorial. Some of them are scavengers. Some of them feed on dung. Some of them feed on plant material. And so there's all different types of beetles that you can find throughout the world. These particular beetles that we're looking at here, these are dung beetles. They basically feed on the organic material within dung. All of you know what dung is? Fecal material or poop. Okay. So you'll find them, like, for example, in elephant dung or something like that. These are actually out of Africa. Not only do the beetles have an elytron, but typically their entire body is sclerotized. You can see this beetle here, that it looks hard on the underside of the beetle, and that's true of most beetles. About the only beetles that aren't really hard on the underside are beetles that are living in dead animals, say for example a dead deer, and basically the sclerotization of their body and their elytra kind of softens up a little bit because of the dead and decaying organic material around them. Okay. Also, beetles live in many habitats. Where would this beetle live, do you think? In the water. You can see the oar-like legs there. And so there are beetles that live in the water. Beetles, as I mentioned, they're scavengers. You can find them almost everywhere in the world. Okay. We could probably go out today if we really wanted to. And just around campus here, we could probably find 15 or 20 different beetle species just on campus. Okay. Any questions about the beetles? Some of them will have camouflage, like this one does here on its elytron. Okay. Any questions about the beetles? The next order is the order Siphonaptera. The order Siphonaptera are your fleas. Okay. Now the fleas are almost a microscopic group of insects. Again, their length is about a millimeter to 2 millimeters long. You can see them with the naked eye, but just barely. The fleas are very important to humans because they do spread diseases. What fleas feed on is they feed on the body fluids of vertebrates, such as humans, or rodents, or some other vertebrate. Even they'll feed on snakes, lizards, so forth. But the fleas, they don't have any wings. However, if you look very closely, you can see a wing bud here. So they're an advanced animal. They've lost their wings through evolution, so it's an evolutionary digression. Key characteristic of the fleas is that they're small and they have hind jumping legs. You're not going to mistake these for the Orthoptera with the grasshoppers, right? Because simply their size. Typically, fleas are also laterally compressed, which means that their bodies are squished side to side. Okay. But fleas are vectors of some diseases that have been important to the human population. For example, one time in history, about half the population of Europe was killed by a disease called the plague, okay, the Black Plague. And the Black Plague is spread by fleas, there are really a few different ways that you can get Black Plague from the fleas. One way is when they bite you, the very first thing they do, just like a mosquito, is they spit an anticoagulant into you. And the plague bacterium can be spread that way. Another way is as they're feeding, they're constantly defecating, and they have these little not really hooks, but kind of spiny-like structures on their leg. And as they're defecating, they're constantly moving their legs, and they can push their fecal material down into your pores. Okay, and you can get the plague that way. You'll die the quickest, however, if you inhale fleas. Fleas are small enough you can inhale them. And if you inhale a flea with the plague, then the plague can get started in your lungs. Okay. And as I mentioned, the plague is a very serious disease. All right. Did I tell you that Ring Around the Rosies is the song about the plague? Do we have plague outbreaks in the world today? Yeah, the bubonic plague. How about in Utah?
West Nile.
Actually, we do. Okay. Usually, they don't affect human populations too much. But for example, it's been about 5 years ago. We had an outbreak of bubonic plague in Utah. Okay. And the organisms that they affected were the Utah prairie dog. I don't know how many of you have been down by Bryce Canyon, but there's little signs about this endangered prairie dog down there called the Utah prairie dog. There's quite a few of them on the Parker Mountains, all the way from there down Bryce Canyon and Cedar City. There's actually a population up by Gunnison as well. But these Utah prairie dogs, they're on the threatened and endangered species list. Well, I was working during the summer for a group of people that manage the Parker Mountains called State Institutional Trust Lands. And there are quite a few researchers doing research out on the Parker Mountains, mainly from Utah State. And they had this big plague outbreak in prairie dogs. And so what scientists started to do to try and save the prairie dogs is they would do what they call dust the prairie dogs. They go to these prairie dog colonies and you use like a kind of like a reverse vacuum and push insecticides into the prairie dog holes, hopefully killing the fleas. And as I talked to one graduate student out there on the Parker Mountain, he was doing research on these prairie dogs. He'd been following the same colony for 3 years on a PhD project. And during this plague epidemic, he lost over 90% of the prairie dog population. Okay. And so scientists throughout the state of Utah were scrambling to get these dusters to put insecticides on the prairie dogs. So we still have outbreaks of the plague. Some places in the world, fleas can be a large problem. I lived in the inner city of Houston for a while, and we had flea problems in our apartment. And they can just drive you crazy at nights, especially. And some of you may have had experiences with fleas before. This is another picture of a flea, a little bit larger one. Any questions about the fleas? The next order is the order Diptera. Di means what? Two. So their order name actually means two wings. However, we said when insects have wings, they typically have four wings or two pairs of wings. The order Diptera are commonly what we call the flies, okay? And when you look at a fly, really all you can see are two wings. And so that's therefore the name order Diptera. But if you were to look at a fly very closely, you would actually see that they have two pairs of wings. It's just that one pair of wings is very reduced. So if we were to look at the body of a fly, the thorax, what you see is a wing that looks something typically like this, right? And then what you really don't see because it's so small is there's a little tiny nub of a wing behind that forewing. And that little nub is what we call a halter. And this halter is a set of wings, but they're just reduced. But again, typically when you see a fly, you only see the front two wings. Now these halters are actually important to the fly. They help them, they use them kind of as a rudder. If you want to have fun with a fly, catch a live fly. We used to do this in junior high, and then you'd pull a girl's hair out, has long hair, long strand of hair. You can throw a lasso around their head and then let them fly, you have a pet fly. And if you pull the
if you pull the one of the halteres off, they'll start doing all sorts of weird tricks and stuff. And you've all seen flies on the ground where they're sitting buzzing around in a circle. That's probably because they have a damaged halter. Okay. So the halter is kind of like a rudder on a plane.
Now the flies are a very important order for humans as well. This is a typical fly here. We commonly call this particular fly a mosquito. In the world today, more people die from diseases that are vectored by flies than any other group, than any other group of vectors. We've talked about malaria, which is the disease that still kills more people than any other in the world today. It's vectored by mosquitoes, okay? House flies and other flies are also important vectors of disease. They can vector things such as cholera, dysentery, other epidemics that periodically break out among human populations. For example, you might have heard that in refugee camps, for example, cholera is a very common disease. Okay, why is it so common in refugee camps? Yeah, basically the flies are vectoring the disease, but what's happening is those flies, for example, if you're out in the having a barbecue, the fly that lands on your hot dog may just have been where? Yeah, it might have been over on some fecal material, or it could have been on a dead animal, okay? And so what happens in refugee camps where there's a lot of people that are in real close contact with one another, typically they don't have the best sanitation in those camps, and so the flies will fly from the fecal material to the faces of the people or their hands or something, and they don't get washed. And so you can have epidemics of fly-borne diseases. It's kind of interesting, the number one reason why people died as they were coming across the plains to settle Utah, California, and Oregon was actually fly-borne diseases. As I've read some histories, this is more common if you read female histories of people that traveled across the plains to Utah, California, and Oregon. The females that wrote journals were constantly complaining of the fly problems. Okay. If you think about it, coming across the plains, hundreds of thousands of people were coming across the same pathways. Not only did you have people and their fecal material, but all of the horses and mules and cows and everything else. You can imagine the fly problems that they had. But that was still one of the main, it is the main way that people died coming across the plains. This particular fly here causes some problems in Africa. It's called a tsetse fly, and it vectors a disease called African sleeping sickness. Any questions about flies? Oh, I should mention that a lot of the flies look like bees. They mimic bees, the reason why they mimic bees is so that predators, for example humans, will leave them alone. About half the time when I see people jumping around because there's bees flying around their head in the summertime, they're actually not bees, they're flies. They're bee mimics. Okay. Any questions about the flies? The next order is the order Lepidoptera. The order Lepidoptera are your butterflies and moths. And this particular order is fairly easy to distinguish because they have very large wings in relationship to their body size, and their wings have scales on them most of the time. Okay. And so, and sometimes those scale patterns make their wings very, very beautiful. You've all seen a butterfly like this before, right? They have very large wings, scales on their wings that are typically colored, and so they're very beautiful. We probably know more about butterflies than almost any other group of insect. And the reason why is because amateurs, as well as scientists, collect and study butterflies and moths because they're so beautiful. Okay, you can actually join amateur butterfly societies. They're called Lepidopteran societies throughout the world. And actually, one of the ways that I worked my way through college was collecting butterflies and mounting them and then selling them. You ever seen those before? Like in pictures or... I'd sell them to craft stores.
you don't make a lot of money because it takes a long time to mount them up and get them to look beautiful. But, you know, as a college student, I don't know about you guys, but, you know, any way that I could make a dollar, it was, you know, a dollar that I didn't have before. So, they're very, very beautiful. Again, we know quite a bit about the butterflies and the moths. The difference between a butterfly and a moth is butterflies have this, have antennae that have little bulbs on the end. They're kind of narrow at the base, and then they have a thick bulb at the end. Whereas moths usually have comb-like or feather-like antennae. That's the easiest way to tell the difference between butterflies and moths. Their main food is nectar of flowers. If you've ever seen a butterfly's mouth part or a moth's mouth part, a lot of times they'll fly with them curled up underneath their head. But they're kind of like, they're what we call siphoning mouth parts. They're like a straw, and they use them. They use their mouth parts to collect nectar. Okay. Here's a few butterflies here. You can also see a beetle here, a coleopteran, and some hymenopterans over here. This is a moth. You can see the siphoning mouth part. You can't see the antennae too well, but they look kind of blurry, and that's because they're comb-like. They look like a comb. Okay. So is this one, is it a butterfly or a moth? The answer is neither one. Okay. This is, you can see the long siphoning mouth part here, but this is another group of lepidopterans that are called skippers. Skippers, their bodies kind of look moth-like, but their antennae look more like butterfly antennae. However, they have this little hook on the end of their antennae. Another way you can tell skippers from butterflies and moths is when butterflies or moths hold or at rest, when they're not moving their wings or when they're just kind of sitting on a flower or something, their wings, their forewings and hind wings are usually hooked together. They work together. In a skipper, you can't really see it real well in this picture, but when they're at rest, their hind wing sits up and their forewing kind of bends to the side, so it kind of looks V-shaped when they're sitting there. Any questions about the lepidopterans? The last order within the class Insecta that we're going to talk about is the order Hymenoptera. The order Hymenoptera includes your bees, wasps, ants, and their allies. Okay. The Hymenoptera are the most advanced group of insects from an evolutionary perspective. If we look at the wings of a Hymenopteran, such as these honeybees, notice there's not a lot of cross-venation in the wings. The order name Hymenoptera refers to this front vein of the wing, and the Hymenoptera, when they do have wings, that front vein is very thick. That's called the hymen. Okay. However, some of the Hymenoptera do not have wings. So probably the easiest way to tell Hymenoptera, if you're just trying to identify them, is to look at where the thorax and the abdomen join together. Remember when I drew a picture of an ant last time up here, how they had a narrow-waisted abdomen? That's true of all Hymenopterans. You can kind of see with these bees here, it looks like it's pinched between the thorax and abdomen, and that's fairly unique among the insects. Okay. In the Hymenoptera, most of the Hymenoptera do have asexual reproduction, which is fairly unique for the insects, and they have parthenogenetic asexual reproduction. Some of the Hymenopterans are social, however, the vast majority of Hymenopterans are not social. Okay, they're solitary or non-clonal. Another behavior that we see in Hymenopterans that we don't see in other insects is we see something that's called gregariousness. Okay, some Hymenopterans that some people would consider clonal are actually not clonal, but they are gregarious. Okay, what gregarious means is that you like to be around others of your type. Okay, some of you may be gregarious. If you constantly like to be around other people, that means you're gregarious. Okay, if you're like me, I'd rather not be around a whole lot of people. I'm kind of solitary. All right. So some of the Hymenopterans are gregarious. For example, you've all seen paper wasps before, right? the ones that build nests around your home and stuff in the summertime, they're actually not, that's actually not a colony of wasps. What it is it's a gregarious group of wasps. What they're doing is they kind of build an apartment complex, so to speak. They're not going to protect each other really, but what they're protecting is their own individual apartment in the apartment complex. Okay, so they just like to be around other wasps. Does that make sense to everybody? Any questions about the Hymenoptera? Also with the Hymenoptera, the sting of the Hymenoptera can be fairly serious. And you only find the stings in the female Hymenopterans. What it is it's a modified ovipositor. So if you can tell the difference between a male Hymenopteran and a female Hymenopteran, you can actually just grab the males out of the air and they won't sting you. They cannot sting you. Okay. So my kids always get a big kick out of that because I can tell the difference between some species of bees, the males and the females, just by looking at them. So I'll grab the male bee and they think that's really neat that I can grab a bee. But every once in a while I make a mistake and then they think it's really funny because it's dumb. Okay. Probably the worst stings of any Hymenopterans I've experienced are one that they call a velvet ant. It's actually a wingless wasp. We have them around here. They look like ants, but they kind of looks like they have hair on them. The other one is the palm-pillared wasps. We have some wasps around here that are about this long, and they have a sting about that long. And let me tell you, when you get stung by one of those, it'll make you cry. Okay, it puts you down. But the velvet ants, I've been stung once by one of those, and I never want to have that happen again. Another common name for them are cow killers, and I learned why. I was stung on my arm, and it hurt so bad, I seriously thought about cutting my arm off. I mean, it just put me down. It's probably one of the most intense pains I've ever been through. My whole arm swole up and everything else. Again, this is another Hymenopteran. You can tell because of that narrow waisted abdomen again. This is an ant. You can see that narrow waisted abdomen, which is typical of the Hymenoptera. And this is a wasp here. Any questions about the Hymenoptera? Any questions about the Arthropoda or the Insecta before we move on to the next phylum? Okay, the next phylum that we want to talk about is the phylum Echinodermata. The phylum Echinodermata are a group of organisms that include the sea stars, the feather stars, the sea cucumbers, sand dollars, sea urchins, okay? That group of organisms. So when we look at the anatomy of an echinoderm, they actually have a different type of symmetry than most of the other animals that we've been talking about. They have what we call pentaradial symmetry. So they have the radially symmetric in the middle, what we call the oral-boral axis. Okay, and then they have five arms coming off of that central oral-boral axis. And so they have what we call pentaradial symmetry. Okay. Now, do you think this is a very advanced characteristic from an evolutionary perspective or fairly primitive? It is fairly primitive. And we've been talking about the animals from least advanced to most advanced, right? So why are the echinoderms considered to be an advanced animal? Well, they have two characteristics that we have, and we think we're the most advanced animals, so since they have the same types of characteristics, they must also be fairly advanced from an evolutionary perspective, right? The first of those is they have an endoskeleton. This is the first group of animals that we've talked about that does have an endoskeleton. The second characteristic that makes the echinoderms advanced from an evolutionary perspective is the type of development that they have. They actually have deuterous stomate development. All of the other coelomate organisms that we've talked about before this have protostomate development. So that deuterous stomate development and an endoskeleton is why we consider them to be more advanced from an evolutionary perspective.
They actually have a water vascular system, so they bring water into their body, and that's how gas exchange occurs. That water vascular system is also important in mobility. They use them. They use these structures called tube feet. The way that their tube feet function is it's kind of like a water balloon. So here they have their skeleton, and they'll have a little hole in their skeleton, and they have a little water balloon-like structure that's called a tube foot. And on the inside of, this is the inside of the sea star, for example, what they do is they have this structure here, it's called an ampulla. This is called the tube foot. When they want to attach their tube foot to something, they have muscles that surround this ampulla and they squeeze the ampulla. And as they squeeze the ampulla, the water moves from the ampulla into the tube foot and allows the tube foot to expand, and it makes the tube foot look like it has a sucker on the end. Okay, so it can attach to a substrate and pull the organism along. Any questions about that? Sea stars, or I should say Echinodermata, they can reproduce either sexually or asexually. One way in which they can reproduce is just simply by dividing their body and regenerating it. As long as, if you were to cut a sea star up, as long as it had part of its central oral laboral axis, it would, and if you put it in a good environment, it should grow the entire sea star back. Okay? And so if you cut it up in multiple pieces, you could have multiple sea stars, for example. Also, the sea stars and most of the echinoderms have two stomachs. And their stomach is found here, right here in the central oral laboral axis. This is the aboral end, or where you would find the anus. The oral end is up underneath there, okay? And what happens is especially sea stars, their main food are bivalves, like clams and so forth. Now, if any of you have ever tried opening a clam, it's pretty hard to do, right? Because they have muscles that hold the shells together. So what the sea star does is it gets around the clam or the bivalve, and then what it does is it flips both of its stomachs inside out. It wedges its stomach down inside of the clam and releases digestive enzymes. And pretty soon, the muscles in the clam start to weaken because of those digestive enzymes. They'll pop the clam open, suck their stomachs right side in again, and then feed on the clam or the bivalve. Okay. However, in the echinoderms, typically the anus is non-functional. And so what they do is instead of having their digestive waste go out of their anus, they'll just flip their stomach inside out and dump their waste out of their mouth. Okay. Any questions about the sea stars? So the first class within the phylum Echinodermata we want to talk about is the class Asteroidea, which are your sea stars. Sea stars are typically found in shallow marine environments. This is your typical sea star here. This picture of a sea star that we're looking at is actually, what we're looking at here is just the skeleton of the sea star. A lot of times people will bring skeletons of sea stars home from the ocean. It's just kind of the endoskeleton. Some of the sea stars are quite beautiful. They have bright colors, especially in marine environments. Okay. This is another sea star here. And another sea star. This is actually showing a sea star. This is a muscle here, a bivalve. You can see the 2 feet holding the muscle in place, and it has its stomach turned inside out inside of that bivalve there. Okay. The larvae of echinoderms are bilaterally symmetric. This is the larvae of a sea star. The next class is the class Echinoidea. The class Echinoidea includes the sea urchins and sand dollars. And again, they're found typically in shallow marine environments. Most of you have seen sand dollars before, such as the sand dollar here. This isn't a great picture of one. This is a much better picture here. You can actually see the pentaradial symmetry. Here's the central oral laboral axis. Here's an arm here, there's one here, I think there's one here. I'm too close to the picture to see. I think one's here and one's here, isn't it? Step back, boys. What they do is they actually secrete kind of a slimy substance that collects sand, and then that sand glues around their body, and they use that as a protective structure in the sea stars, or in the sand dollars, excuse me. This is a sea urchin. Now with the sea urchins, you don't see the five appendages or arms, and actually they don't have the pentaradial symmetry in terms of having arms. But if you were to look at a sea urchin skeleton, what you would see is five arm scars. So at one point in their evolutionary past, they did have five arms. There's a scar here, and one here that you can see. Okay. And the sea urchins are scavengers for the most part. Any questions about the sea urchins or sand dollars? This is a sea urchin that's called a pin urchin, and it has some... Actually, those big long barbs that you see are outgrowths of the endoskeleton. The next class is the class Holothuroidea. The class Holothuroidea are your sea cucumbers. Sea cucumbers can be found in shallow marine waters to somewhat moderate depths in marine environments. Sometimes you can even find a few sea cucumbers at very deep depths in the ocean. They're usually found around hydrothermal vents if you find them deep in the ocean. But the Holothuroidea, or sea cucumbers, look just like a cucumber, therefore their common name. These organisms also don't look like they have pentaradial symmetry, but they actually do have five arms. What happens with the sea cucumbers is they actually have a layer of skin that runs outside of their arms, and so it actually is kind of deceiving. They actually do have five arms. Kind of imagine if you were to run a blanket all the way around me with my arms out like this. Once you ran the blanket around me, you couldn't see my arms, right? But my arms would still be there. That's kind of like what the sea cucumbers have. They have five arms, but there's a layer of skin that drapes around their arms, around the tips of their arms. Okay. Any questions about the sea cucumbers? There's another sea cucumber here. And you can actually see the shadows from the arms. There's one shadow right here, one up there from the arms. Okay. Any question about the phylum Echinodermata? Okay. The last class that we're going to talk about this semester in the Kingdom Animalia is the phylum Chordata. The phylum Chordata is the phylum that we belong to. The phylum Chordata has an endoskeleton. They also have deuterostomate development, so the echinoderms and the chordates are the only two phyla that have deuterostomate development. All of the rest of the triploblastic coelomate organisms have protostomate development. So when we say all of the rest of the triploblastic coelomate organisms, the first group of coelomate organisms with protostomate development that we talked about was the mollusca. So from the mollusca up through arthropoda, they all have protostomate development. Okay. With the phylum Chordata, all chordates must have four chordate characteristics at the same time and at least at some point in their life cycle. And those four chordate characteristics are as follows. The first is that they need to have a dorsal tubular nerve cord. So chordates have a dorsal brain, dorsal tubular nerve cord. Okay, so dorsal tubular nerve cord is one of those four characteristics. They all must have what we call a notochord. And that notochord runs just ventral to the dorsal tubular nerve cord. And that's actually where the phylum name comes from. The phylum name Chordata comes from the notochord. Now, what we're going to see a little bit later is that some of the chordates, the notochord during developmental processes is actually going to grow up and around that dorsal tubular nerve cord and form some structures that we call vertebrae. And so, we've mentioned the vertebrates before. The vertebrates are a subgroup of the chordata. Okay? And what vertebrae are is they're just simply the notochord that grows up around the dorsal tubular nerve cord. Right? So, dorsal tubular nerve cord, the notochord. Third characteristic that all chordates must have at some point in their development are pharyngeal gill slits. Okay. So if you have pharyngeal gill slits, you also have what? Gills. Did you all know at one point in your life you had gills?
What's that?
So I wish I didn't know.
Yeah. Actually, when you were very, very young, fetus, you had gills at one point. Okay. And actually, we've lost that characteristic as adults, but at one point we had gill slits and gills. In fact, you can see the remnants of our gill slits and gill arches in our body today. If you think about it, if there's gill slits, there also has to be gill arches, right, in between the gill slits. And your Adam's apple is actually a gill arch. So here's a gill slit here, one here. This was a gill arch, your bottom jaw. Gill slit where your mouth is. Another gill arch where your top jaw is. Another gill slit where your nose is, and then another gill arch up here over the top of your nose. Okay. Any questions about that? Okay, so dorsal tubular nerve cord, notochord, pharyngeal gill slits, and the last of the four chordate characteristics is a postanal tail. So what a postanal tail is, it's a tail that is behind the anus. Now, did all of you know that you had a tail at one point in your development? Actually, your tail at one point in your development was almost as long as your entire body. In humans, we as adults, or as developed humans, our tail is very reduced. But we still have a tail, right? Which we call our tailbone. Some of you might have broken your tail before. Okay. Any questions about that? So all chordates at some point in their development must have a dorsal tubular nerve cord, notochord, pharyngeal gill slits, postanal tail. All right. Now, as you can imagine, as we've talked about with the humans, many of the chordates are going to lose some or all of those characteristics when they become adults. Okay. But during development, all chordates must have those four chordate characteristics at the same time. All right. Any questions about that? Okay. So on Wednesday, we're going to continue talking about the phylum Chordata. We're going to